This is the Annie Fry Show.
Rubio, will you call for
some No, I will not. On the contrary.
Rubio,
are you filming it?
Wait,
I want you guys to get this. I want them to destroy every element of Hamas they can get their hands on. These people are vicious animals who did horrifying crimes. And I hope you guys post that.
And what about the civilians that are being killed every day?
Hamas should stop hiding behind civilians, putting civilians in the way. Hamas knew that this was going to lead to this. So Hamas should stop building their military installations underneath hospitals.
So you don't care that 15,000 have died? You don't care about the babies that are being killed every day?
Horrifying. I think it's terrible, and I think Hamas is 100% to blame.
That is Marco Rubio, Senator Marco Rubio, potentially Donald Trump's pick for Secretary of State. I don't believe that's officially been confirmed yet. But when you listen to that flashback of Senator Rubio being asked by a reporter in the halls of the United States Senate about the 15,000 people who are dead, and he directly puts the blame and the onus on Hamas for those deaths, says he would not call for a ceasefire. Donald Trump picks him to be the Secretary of State. I would assume there's a brand new mentality that's going to be in town, and the world is about to know it. Our guest, Jim Carafano, once again, senior counselor to the president and E.W. Richardson Fellow for International Engagement at the Heritage Foundation. Jim, we have a result. We have a president-elect Donald Trump. And from my understanding, the world has already taken notice.
Yeah, I'm really liking the team. And let me tell you, and by the way, they just announced that Mike Huckabee is going to be the ambassador to Israel, which is fantastic.
Oh, that's great.
So here's what I like. Is first of all, as somebody who was there in 2016 and worked on presidential transition, this is a much more coherent team. These are people that know how to work. By everyone that we've seen so far, know how to work with the president, share the trust and confidence of the president, share his vision. I actually think it's great that they're not exactly uniform on every single policy. Let me tell you why. The modern conservative movement, which is by the way, a hell of a lot bigger this week than it was last week, is not about driving for a particular orthodoxy. That's the left. Everybody must believe this. Conservatives base their desire on delivering what's best for the American people. And when it comes to foreign policy, it's what's in America's best interest. So it's not about an orthodoxy. It's not about, well, we think we should always do this or we should always do that. It's about people who believe in America and its interest and are willing to sit down with their president and make principled arguments about what the right policy is, and then respect the decision that the president made, because he will make a decision, and he will impose it forcefully, and move forward. That is the best you could ask for. Donald Trump actually thrives on people disagreeing, and on people having their own opinion, and on people willing to be honest about their opinion, and then, as long as they're willing to trust their president when their president makes a decision, to ruck up like a good soldier and move on. So I think this is a very, on the national security front, if it's Waltz and if it's Rubio and Elliot, the Stefanik at the UN, and Huckabee is an ambassador. And oh, by the way, can't tell you how excited I am that he's naming ambassadors right away and putting them out there, because they are the face of American foreign policy.
Can you drill down on that a little bit, too? Because I don't think people really, big Secretary of State, Chief of Staff, these are the big things that nationally we look at. But how important are these ambassadorships? What is their representation?
It's funny you should say that, because, my view on this has really changed in the last 2 years as I've been all over the world. I used to think, what is an ambassador? I mean, they kiss babies and, they have 4th of July parties. They don't actually do foreign policy. Foreign policy is done by the State Department, and they're almost kind of an anachronism. That's totally not true. An ambassador on the ground, particularly in a mid-sized and smaller country, has so much power and influence and respect, and their role is so critical. And when they enjoy the confidence of the President of the United States, that is a very, very powerful individual. So Trump, the first time around, had a number of political appointees as ambassadors, many of them with no foreign policy experience, who were really some of the most effective and representatives we had, and were stellar. And so the fact that the president kind of got that, and he's leading with some not just cabinet officials, but embassy nominations, particularly our critical places like Israel, that is a very, very positive and constructive side.
We're speaking with Jim Carafano. I've been looking forward to this conversation ever since the results came in, because you and I have had so many conversations about the tone of how America is looked at, respected, disrespected in the world. It really starts at the top. And you've made the case before that should this election go one way or the other, the world will react before the next president is inaugurated. And we're about a week out now of the election results. Has the world responded so far?
Oh, I think we've already seen signs of that. I think in our friends and allies, particularly those who aren't really Trump fans, that the byword is be pragmatic and responsible. And in our enemies, that, you know, the vacation's coming to an end. And I think we're really seeing some bits of, you know, we need to be a little more risk averse about dealing with Donald Trump. I got to tell you the most promising thing, and how many times, I mean, you and I have been talking about the border and immigration for 4 years. But when the president announces that Tom Homan is a real border czar, the guy that's basically going to be sitting with Steve Miller in the White House, personally directed this effort, and working with a professional in DHS like Kristi Noem, who's a governor who gets this. I've known Tom Homan forever. This man is an idol to me. He is the most relentless, professional, committed public servant I have ever seen. He just reminds me so much of my dad. My dad was a cop, and Tom Homan is, you know, he bleeds blue. And I mean, if his appointment doesn't send a signal to the human traffickers around the world that this, the game is up, then I don't know what, you know, I don't know what will. It's awesome.
Jim Carafano speaking with us right now. I love that you put it that way, because the message that is sent with these appointments, you know, there are people who are maybe halfway on their trek to cross the southern border. They're trying to get away from, you know, drug gang ridden neighborhoods. They're trying to come to America for a better place. They've been told that that's what they're going to get here. But it's an entire industry. Humans have become a commodity. There are people who are terrible, terrible people who are getting incredibly wealthy off of this game that the Democrats have set up in office over the last 4 years. Does this get violent on the southern border before it gets better?
I don't know. We'll see how that goes, but it's a battle they'll lose. We can get control of our southern border. Something Tom said today, which I think people already pay attention to, he said self-deport. He said if you're in America illegally or in one of these programs that's blatantly illegal and is going to get terminated on day one, leave. And that sounds cruel, but it's smart. And let me tell you why. Because the way this works is, if ICE picks you up, they're gonna immediately detain you. You don't get to go back home. You don't get to change your underwear. You don't get to talk to your employees. You don't get to talk to your boss. You don't get to talk to your family, your kids. You're going into detention, and likely you'll be held in detention till you're put out on a plane. And if you want to fight detention, fine. You can stay in there for months and years, or you can just agree to be deported. If you're smart and you're in this country, and if you have family, if you have kids, if you have a business, if you're smart, what you will do is you will get your affairs in order and you'll leave the country, because then you control your destiny and the fate of you and your family and your business interests and then maybe you can reapply to come back legally. But otherwise, every day of your life, you're going to be walking around wondering, is today the day I'm going to get picked up, thrown out of the country? And when you get put in detention, you're going to be put in there with rapists and murderers, and it's not a pleasant experience. And if your answer is I'll just hide in America, your life will be miserable, and yeah. you just wish you had been back home. It the price is too high. Just leave, clean slate, go. Yeah.
That is wonderful advice, and hopefully people will heed it. I live in the state of Illinois, right across the river here in Mississippi. My governor, J.B. Pritzker, has finally defined who he's working for. If they come for his people, they'll have to go through him. That's what he says. I don't feel very cared for as a taxpayer in that state right now. What do governors like J.B. Pritzker in the state of Illinois, Newsom in California, Hochul in New York, when they say that they will stand in front of these people who are illegal in their states, benefiting from the taxpayer dollars being taken from those people in their states, When they say that they're going to protect them from Tom Holman and the Donald Trump administration on deportation, do they have a leg to stand on?
Well, there's no law that says they have to cooperate with the federal government in enforcement of immigration law. But there is actually a law that says if they interfere with the federal government in the pursuit of enforcing federal law, they've committed a crime. So if he's saying, I'm going to commit a crime, then he's going to be a criminal. That's just, if he wants to, you know, try to impede the federal government in some way that doesn't violate the law, then he's just being an idiot. He's spending money and power and whatever, you know, in pursuit of things that people in his state don't even want.
Does sanctuary status, sanctuary state, sanctuary city, does that mean anything?
Not. I mean, there is no legal stature of being a sanctuary, whatever. Basically, what it used to mean was, we will not help you enforce federal immigration law, which does make it harder to deport people. But what they'll do, and look, I know Tom Holman, I know exactly what he's doing. Raise your hand up and said, oh, well, we're not going to do this in my city. Tom Holman will flood that city with ICE agents, and they'll be standing there at the doors when you release somebody from jail and you refuse to turn them over for ICE. ICE is going to stand there at the door, and they're going to screen everybody that's leaving to see if they're illegal or not. They will flood your state. And, you know, the problem with the sanctuary thing is it's not a state's right thing, because you actually are impeding on the civil liberties of the people in your own state. And you essentially create a law-free zone. You're telling people, if you're a criminal alien, come to my community because we won't be looking for criminal aliens here. It's nuts.
It's outrageous.
And it's going to, I think, really, it's the kind of attention that nobody wants.
Before we let you go, I have the story popped up, and I think it's amusing, but I kind of feel like it puts a positive tone on the future, at least in this president-elect period of time before Donald Trump is inaugurated once again. Fox News reports that South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol, I hope I said that correctly, has reportedly started practicing his golf game in anticipation of meeting president-elect Donald Trump. It says he goes on to say that he is looking forward to the opportunity to meet him. Days after the call with Donald Trump, Yoon, quote, got out his golf clubs for the first time in 8 years and resumed his golf practice. It may seem like a small thing, but a world leader is trying to figure out how to connect with President Trump. That must mean the influence there is pretty strong.
Yeah, that's not it. Yeah, I'm sorry. I mean, fine, get out your golf clubs and play golf, and the president. But this is a mistake that people, you know, Abe did this. And people thought, oh, Abe would, you know, flatter Trump, and he was really nice to him. And Abe got he was the president, he was the prime minister of Japan. That's not in the end. I mean, Trump likes to have a personal relationship with somebody. That's great. But in the end, is this in America's interest? What made Abe the first really successful world leader to work with Donald Trump is he brought things to the table that were good for Japan and good for the United States, and Trump responded to that. So all the atmospherics are nice, but it's not playing flattery in golf that's going to, in the end, get you a great relationship with Donald Trump.
Yeah, it's policy. And it's correct. So good to see that Donald Trump has acted so quickly with so many of the cabinet appointments that he got straight to work. There's no time off. I have a feeling you and I will have much to talk about in a more positive tone in the weeks to come. Jim, you've been spot on this entire time since Joe Biden was inaugurated. And I'm so happy to be on this end of this conversation with you. We always appreciate you.
Good talking with you.
Talk to you again soon. Jim Carafano, our friend here on the Annie Frye Show, senior counselor to the president and E.W. Richardson Fellow for International Engagement at the Heritage Foundation. He literally travels the world talking to the people who matter and who are the decision makers, policy makers, and influencers across the globe on these things. And it's always great to have him on. Now, when we come back, Will Scharf is in studio with us. Of course, one of Donald Trump's attorneys, a former federal prosecutor right here in the Eastern District of Missouri. But there was some significant news that came out today regarding the situation of Donald Trump's legal situation. Let me play for you this clip here real quick before we go to break. Bill Hemmer reports for Fox News.
It is 10 a.m. in New York City, and we've got a ruling based on the Associated Press saying this a moment ago. The judge has delayed made a ruling on whether or not to dismiss President-elect Donald Trump's criminal conviction. These are 34 counts that came in at the end of May, May 30th, and the former president's been fighting it ever since, and the judge is going to sentence him prior to the election, then delayed it given the election itself, and so this is the ruling here. Just reading from the AP, a New York State judge has paused proceedings in the already decided criminal case on charges stemming from the hush money paid to a porn star. All right. The document reads the judge had been set to decide by today whether or not the conviction could be vacated due to the ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court midsummer back in July on presidential immunity. Trump had also been scheduled to be sentenced on November 26. So this now is a whole new ball of wax.
So Bill Hemmer reporting this, and I was listening to this all morning and listening to Andy McCarthy, Jonathan Turley, Shannon Bream, among other legal experts on Fox News. A lot of different takes on it, but it seems like more of the same. The thought that I have on all of this right now is that this was a passive-aggressive move from Judge Mershon, but I don't know. I don't understand this. I'm not a legal expert. So we thought, hey, Will Scharf, he's one of Trump's attorneys. Let's talk to him about it. So he's in studio with us for the rest of the 1 o'clock hour. If you've got questions, throw them at us in the Annie Fry YouTube chat, and maybe we'll toss one in our conversation as we bring Will Scharf into the room post-election, celebrating, I don't know, maybe for the next 4 years? Donald Trump's re-election to the presidency of the United States. Will Scharf, next. Welcome back to the Annie Fry Show. We got to start the show. I love the off-air conversations with Will Scharf, but we got to bring him on air with you. And Will, we haven't talked to you on the air since Donald Trump has become president-elect Donald Trump. You feel pretty good about that one?
Annie, I am not tired of winning yet. It has been an incredible week for America. I think we're all having a lot of fun, and I think the next couple weeks are going to be even more fun. So it's exciting stuff.
When you were in, were you at the victory party?
Yeah, I was down in West Palm. Actually,
set
I called,
the stage for us.
So, I mean, obviously thousands of people. We were sort of upstairs in like a hold room. I saw some great Missourians there. Congressman Jason Smith was around. Senator Eric Schmidt with some old buddies of his was hanging around. I was there. My colleague John Sauer was there. So Missouri was well represented at the party. You know, it's a long night. You get there at 6, 7 p.m. And the race, you know, President Trump didn't end up speaking until about 3 a.m. Eastern. Now, as some of your listeners may know, I called the race early.
Yes,
as
you
I
did.
Started, I called the race at 7:44 p.m. Eastern. I'd seen early returns from Indiana and Kentucky that showed Trump running about 1.5 points above where he'd been in 2020.
Wow.
And that was enough for me to call the race. Everyone thought I was crazy. I was running around the party saying, it's over, guys, it's over. And everyone else was a little more nervous than I was. I'm glad I was right because it would have been really embarrassing. but I was on with, I think it was Reardon and yeah. John Lamping, and they were being like super squishy, which I wasn't really expecting from John Lamping. And I said, guys, you know, 95% certainty. I hedged a little bit. It is done. It is dusted. President Trump is the next president of the United States of America.
When we did our watch party on our YouTube channel while Mark Reardon held down the fort here, when we would hear that you were going to be on, we're like, let's listen to Will. Like, we'll shut up and we'll listen to Will. I mean, our relationship with you on this station, we're so grateful for it. You've been at the, like, very near the epicenter of so much American history in the last, how long would it be? Year? 18 months? That you've been really, really close to the center here?
Yeah, you know, started doing work on all this lawfare stuff. I guess it was, you know, the spring of 2023 and formally joined the president's team last August. It's been a wild, wild ride. And I'm just deeply grateful to have had the opportunities that I've had. And I'm deeply grateful that we've had the successes that we've had, because I think beating back this campaign of lawfare really was very important, not just for President Trump, but for the American Republic, for the Constitution, for all the things we hold dear.
Yeah, you know, it was such a tenuous moment. We're not done with it yet. As I understand it, we've got news today on the Mershon hush money porn star case for Donald Trump in New York. But if, you know, what America decided in this election, I don't think it's too too tall of an order to say it was going to make or break the future of this country. When it comes to the people who are in office, able to wield the powers of the justice system against political opponents, I keep saying this. They impeached Donald Trump over that with his phone call with Zelensky. The first impeachment was they were saying that he was trying to dig up dirt on a political opponent who happened to be not even the nominee yet, Joe Biden. They did all of that to the nth degree. If Kamala Harris would have won, what was your fear for Donald Trump and his ability to be free of this lawfare?
Yeah, I mean, look, Kamala Harris being president would be a terribly scary situation for any number of reasons. I mean, seriously, fear for the future of the republic. One of the interesting things, though, is you go back to the first impeachment, you go back to the Russia collusion hoax, and what you see in all of those instances is, you know, we call it the deep state. It's folks within the government who believe that their personal policy preferences, their personal views are more important than the opinions of the American people expressed through their elected representatives. So with the Russia collusion hoax, you saw these guys at CIA and FBI who basically took it upon themselves to attempt to rig the 2016 election. With the first impeachment, you saw these sort of deep staters who were so infuriated by some of President Trump's policy decisions that they felt that their views were more important than those of the elected president of the United States of America. As we move into the second Trump administration, to me, that's the great challenge. How do we recenter American government so that it's truly reflective of the will of the people, and so that it empowers our elected representatives to do the will of the people? This deep state phenomenon, conservatives love to talk about it, but what we're really talking about is several thousand people in D.C. who think they know better than all of us. And that's just not the way America is supposed to work.
To use a Corinne Jean-Pierre phrase, do you believe that President Trump and his administration are clear-eyed in how to accomplish the resetting of that justice system to be blind to these types of things that have caused them in the past to make different judgments?
You know, I'll say this. You look at the appointments that he's made so far in this transition, and there has not been a miss. Susie Wiles will be an outstanding chief of staff. Waltz was, I think, a perfect pick for national security advisor.
Mike Waltz.
Mike Huckabee, you know, ambassador to Israel. Mm-hmm. Elise Stefanik, ambassador to the UN. I think President Trump is sending a very clear message about what the government under him is going to look like and what America is going to stand for around the world. And then you look at sort of closer to home appointments. I mean, Stephen Miller, obviously one of the key masterminds of Trump's successful border and immigration policies the first time around. He's now deputy chief of staff for policy in the White House, an incredibly important position. And then at his side is going to be Homan, you know, on as our new border czar. Think about it. The clearest contrast imaginable. We went from Kamala Harris's border czar to Homan, who's probably the single best person on this issue in the country. I mean, that's what winning looks like. And I'm expecting to see a lot more good news in the next couple days as President Trump continues staffing up this administration.
We're speaking with Will Scharf in studio, a former federal prosecutor for the Eastern District of Missouri. He's also one of Donald Trump's attorneys. I'm going to read to you what the rest of us non-legal experts are consuming about the ruling, or whatever you call it, that came out today in the hush money trial where Donald Trump was convicted of 34 felonies. He's not a convicted felon. I've learned that from you, Will Scharf, but I've heard that from many other legal experts. You're not a convicted felon until you've been sentenced. The Fox News report is that a Manhattan judge overseeing President-elect Donald Trump's trial agreed to grant a stay on all deadlines associated with a felony conviction proceedings against Trump in the final months before he takes office, a closely watched decision that allows Trump to avoid a maximum sentence of up to 4 years in prison. The judge overseeing the case, Judge Juan Merchan, granted the request, which issues a stay on all deadlines, including the November 26 sentencing date, to consider the effect of his election as president. Simplify this in the most elementary of terms, Will, what was this ruling today for
Donald
Trump?
So we had a jury verdict against President Trump in this New York case, which was an absolute garbage case. We call it the zombie case. We then moved to overturn that jury verdict on the basis of presidential immunity, that they introduced all kinds of evidence in that case that shouldn't have been allowed inside that courtroom in light of the Supreme Court's opinion in our presidential immunity appeal that came down on July 1st. That's an issue that we're currently litigating, and we were expecting a ruling from Judge Merchan on that this week. Now, if he were to rule against us on that, we would have a right to appeal, and we could potentially go all the way back up to the U.S. Supreme Court. Once that whole process had played out, potentially a sentencing could occur, and then we'd have the right to appeal that sentencing, appeal that judgment, again, all the way up through the court system to the New York Court of Appeals, the highest court in New York, and again, potentially to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, I say all of that because it is absolute black-letter law that you cannot criminally prosecute or exercise any sort of criminal sanction against a sitting president of the United States of America. You can't throw a president in jail. You can't indict him. You can't put him on trial. You cannot do any of that because of the take care clause in Article 2 of the Constitution and the supremacy clause of the U.S. Constitution. So I think what's become clear in this New York case is by the time they could resolve all of these legal issues, President Trump's going to be back where he belongs in the White House, and none of this is really going to be relevant. So my suspicion is that in the coming weeks, we're going to see that case unwound the same way that we've seen the federal prosecutions move towards final resolution. And I've said this before on your show, Annie. I don't think President Trump will ever be sentenced in that New York case. I don't believe that verdict will end up standing. And I certainly don't think that's going to happen before he takes office.
Does that mean that Donald Trump will be absolved, that this would be expunged, that he has not been convicted? Is the conviction overturned? Like, what is the legalese behind what that means for what we've already seen take place?
So if we were to win on this presidential immunity issue, that would be an overturning of the jury verdict.
Can that happen before the inauguration?
It could. The other option is that Alvin Bragg's team may just drop this case. That would be irregular because they've already gone through a jury trial, but potentially they could just look at the challenges inherent in criminally prosecuting a president-elect or a sitting president and say that, you know, guys, we just can't do this, it's over, and move to dismiss the case. And if Judge Merchan then granted that, it would effectively wipe the slate clean. It's really important to remember, though, and I'll say this again, you cannot criminally prosecute a president, you cannot impose a sentence on a sitting president. And I think there are very strong arguments that even a president-elect, because of the statutory duties that a president-elect has, the supremacy clause comes into play here, and a state prosecution like this New York prosecution simply cannot proceed now that President Trump has been reelected.
I think when a lot of Americans across the country are looking at Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg and New York Attorney General Letitia James, there seems to be a lot of malpractice. It seems to be very disconcerting that this type of lawfare can be levied against a citizen. Do they only answer to the people of Manhattan and New York?
You know, I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens to these bad actors in the next couple months. I hope that the American people understand that what they've done to President Trump simply can't happen again. We can't have this situation where the courts, where prosecution, where even civil actions are weaponized in this way for political purposes, because I truly believe that if that becomes the new norm, it will signal the end of the republic, that we can't have a robust Democratic Republic if the tools of law are going to be misused the way that they have been misused. Tish James has been saying, I think, some outrageous things since the election about how she's going to continue fighting Trump and all that sort of thing. I hope that cooler heads prevail, and I hope that they start to understand that what they've done is just a terribly, terribly wrong thing. You know, I spoke at a press conference after we had appellate arguments in one of the E. Jean Carroll cases, And I said to the press, guys, this is insane. I mean, we can't have a situation where the courts are misused in this way for political purposes. That's not what the courts are designed for. That's not what the law is designed for. We contest elections at the ballot box in America. The American people spoke loudly and clearly last Tuesday, and I think all of these political actors on the left need to take their cue from that.
Well, Will said at the beginning, he's not tired of all the winning in either way. I just feel very, just like the baseline level of happy in my life has dramatically increased in the last week. I actually feel like I breathe full inhales and full exhales right now instead of all those short breaths when you get really nervous. It's good to be on this side of the election, and it's great to have Will Scharf in studio with us. You're going to stick around for another segment, right?
Yeah, sure.
All right. We'll finish out the 1 o'clock hour with Will Scharf in studio, former federal prosecutor for the Eastern District of Missouri, Donald Trump attorney in studio with us here on the Andy Frey Show. Go to the YouTube live and vote in today's poll. Do you trust Trump's judgment on his cabinet picks? Yes or no? A lot of them keep coming. The latest that we've heard here is Ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee. It's another good one. Let us know what you think on the Andy Frey YouTube channel. Come say hi. We'll be right back.
Five ain't working. Why the hell do I work?
They all allege that these actions were made on my own recognizance and that it was for my own political advances. However, if you look at the record, there is what we call a community trend. And unfortunately, it just so happened that the political hostility that was encountered by my team, and I was on two different teams during this deployment, they just so happened to have the Trump campaign signage. FEMA always preaches avoidance first and then de-escalation. So this is not isolated. This is a colossal event of avoidance, not just in the state of Florida, but you will find avoidance in the Carolinas.
That is a fired FEMA employee, Marnie Washington, saying she told her team to avoid Trump homes because of hostility. And this was larger than her. We've got Will Scharf in studio with us for the rest of this hour. Will, I don't know how much you've heard about this story, but it is like it is. Even at this point, nothing really should surprise me. But I know where I was sitting and what I was doing when I read this story, that FEMA was advising their volunteers or whatever agents to skip over homes in Florida in the wake of the hurricane that indicated support for Trump.
Yeah, it's really funny. You know, when you prosecute a street-level drug dealer, if they're facing real time, if they're facing real punishment, more often than not, they will rat out their superiors and they will rat out the organization that they're working for. When you hold a federal bureaucrat accountable the way they did this FEMA employee, she immediately ratted out the larger organization and the bigger picture, which isn't just she was some rogue person discriminating against Trump supporters. What she reveals in that clip that you just played is that this was FEMA policy to effectively discriminate in disaster relief aid against Trump supporters. That is an outrageous scandal. I hope that we get to the bottom of it under the new administration. But just that mindset is so fascinating to me, that these people felt empowered enough to go out and do something that is so clearly wrong, just at a basic moral level wrong, and that she didn't really even see anything wrong with it.
It's so important to think about it in that mentality. Like, if I'm ever doing anything that I'm even considering, like, maybe this isn't 100% right, I have a guilty conscience about me that it's incredibly hindering for me to proceed with whatever that action is. But to be so casual about, like, I'm thinking to my mind, like, why did you type that out?
Yeah.
Why would you type out to skip Trump homes if you are willing to type that out? And if you're willing to attest to it in an almost casual way, FEMA can't be the only place that has this mentality.
Yeah, I think these federal bureaucrats just don't think they're accountable to anybody. And they've never been held accountable before. I mean, if this was the policy now, I promise you it was the policy, or that there was a similar policy a year ago, 2 years ago, 4 years ago. I mean, this is baked into the federal bureaucracy. And the greatest challenge President Trump and his team have ahead of them is unwinding this insane deep state, the insane administrative state that's been allowed to build up in our federal government.
Is that easily weeded out?
No, but we're going to get it done. No, I mean,
I'm just very happy about that.
You know, all problems look impossible from the outside, and then you get in and you chip away and you chip away and you chip away, and you aggregate smaller successes into bigger successes, and that's how you drive cultural change. I think what we're going to see in the coming weeks and months, as new cabinet secretaries come in, you're going to see statements from the top that will start to trickle down through the bureaucracy, that good actors in these departments will be promoted, bad actors will be pushed to the side, and over time you can really drive cultural change even in these massive behemoth federal agencies. But that's going to require political will, that's going to require commitment and dedication, and the reason that I'm so enthused about the team that President Trump is putting together is that I think they're all people with the will to get these sorts of things done.
Yeah.
And I'm excited for the next couple of years.
Well, that's our poll for today, is do you trust Trump's judgment on his cabinet pick? Sounds like you're a yes.
So far, they've been great. Lee Zeldin will be outstanding at EPA. Yeah. This is a congressman with just a ton of experience on environmental issues and on dealing with the federal government, which is a key piece of this. We'll see more cabinet appointments in the coming days, coming weeks. But so far, so good.
Would you accept transportation secretary?
I don't know if I can follow Mayor Pete. I mean, you know.
The qualification standard is super high.
Yeah, the Dems always hate on, you know, Republican appointees. Then they put Pete Buttigieg in charge of transportation.
He was the mayor of South Bend, Indiana,
and
Mr.
then he
Sharf.
Disappeared for 6 months on paternity leave when you had, like, the biggest supply chain crisis in American
train
history.
Wrecks.
You had train
spills.
Wrecks, airplanes falling out of the sky. There was that big ship in the Suez Canal.
It's like, maybe the worst section of transportation catastrophes.
Everything
in the
was coming apart, and Pete Buttigieg is off on leave. Where's
I think you should throw your name in
secretary?
It. You would be an improvement.
They're holding him up as a potential Democrat presidential candidate now for 2028. I mean, this is the worst transportation secretary in the history of transportation or secretaries. What are these people thinking?
Oh, man. Will Sharf in studio with us right now. I'm looking at the attorney general appointment as, to me in my mind, maybe you could redirect my thought on this, is the most important pick that he has to make. How do you feel about where that might be headed?
Yeah, you know, J.D. Vance said during the campaign that other than president, AG may be the most important slot in the federal government. And I think particularly in terms of all the change we need to drive in DOJ, that rings true to me. Based on the press reports, they're considering some really outstanding candidates, including, I'll say, you know, there have been press reports that Andrew Bailey, our attorney general's under active consideration. Bailey and I obviously fought out a bitter primary, but, you know, I wish him luck. I think he'd be an incredible representative of the state of Missouri in the federal government, and I think it would be a pretty incredible thing for him to be up there. I think that when you look at the Department of Justice, you're going to have these careerists, these deep staters in that department setting landmines for whoever President Trump appoints. Those first couple months are going to be decisive. We have to get our landing teams in. We have to get good staff in. We have to get some of the sub-cabinet level officials there confirmed quickly, and we've got to sort of grab a hold of that beast before it starts tearing us apart. You know, back in 2017, the sort of the careerists pressured Jeff Sessions to recuse himself from the Mueller investigation or from anything relating to the campaign. That was a huge mistake that did real damage to the Trump administration. We have to avoid landmines like that this time around. But every name that I've seen in the press, you know, being considered for that position has been outstanding. You know, another other than Bailey's, Matt Whitaker, former acting attorney general. Mm-hmm.
Cardinal fan.
He's a guy with just, yeah, that's right. He's an Iowa guy.
Yeah.
He's a guy with just tremendous experience in that building who I think would also be a great pick. I haven't seen a name, though, so far that's really made me scratch my head. So I'm excited to see what the transition puts out there.
We have less than a minute left here, but Senate leadership, how important is it?
I think Senate leadership's incredibly important. You know, President Trump's been talking about, you know, the appointment process, you know, how the Senate is going to handle his appointments, you know, vacancy appointments, that sort of thing. We need good leadership in the Senate. I'm not going to take a position on who I think would be the best. A lot of conservatives are really pushing Rick Scott hard. But one way or the other, we all need to be rowing in the same direction, and we need a Republican Party that's really committed to getting the job done and not just talking about it now that we have the reins of power in our hand.
Yeah. Let's not get in our own way here.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's not get in our own way. And I also do like Donald Trump's picks for cabinet. They aren't like... They're kind of from a few different places
yep.
in the Republican Party. That is good for representing a larger Republican Party. Will Scharf, anytime you're free, we've got a microphone open for you.
Great to be with you guys. Thanks so much for having me.
And congratulations to you. You worked very hard on this victory, and we are glad to be able to have you on here to talk about it. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll be back in just a minute with more Annie Fry Show. Good boy.